Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
I don't think this was in the soundtrack of The Nice Guys, but this is kind of the vibe of that movie. I've said Russell Crowe. And who's the hot guy that every woman loves?
Ryan Gosling.
Oh, him.
And
Ryan Gosling.
I guess.
He's very funny. We'll talk to Nick about the movies coming up here in a little bit. 6:12 in the morning, and here's the show today. We've got a lot going on. Chuck Todd will be on at 6:40. And then the reason I'm going to give you the whole lineup today is because I just want you to know that the Sandberg and Jake are getting it done. I don't know who those last two clowns we had in that room were, but thank God we broomed them, huh?
Yeah, I don't even remember their names.
Chuck Todd at 6:40. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at 6:50. And yes, I will ask him about the Supreme Court no vote, as in we were not having a vote.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Brady, Eric Edelstein, and Rick Pearson live from the... is he at the Lincoln Museum?
I thought you were going to say the mess that is Springfield, but I think he is at the Lincoln Museum.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's
what's going on
at
the Lincoln Museum today?
I think he's just going to be doing the remote from there, or doing the interview from there. But Rauner's doing a flyer.
But he couldn't find a phone near Springfield, so he went to the Lincoln Museum?
Rauner might be at the Lincoln Museum,
okay.
But he's doing he's going around the state promoting this, quote, stopgap budget.
Yeah. It's nice that we're in that position now where you've got to hype a kick the can down the road move.
I thought the same thing. I thought just don't even tour. You don't even need to tour the state and waste the gas doing it or fuel.
I don't know, though. I give him credit for trying to do something. Exactly what is Madigan doing? Get back to me on that.
Right.
Dean after 8, of course. Ryan Dempster on baseball at 8:40. Cubs still 21 over 500?
They are 36 and 15, 21 over 500 as of this morning.
And the Pirates are 7.5 back and in second place, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, 7.5. The Cardinals are now 9.5 back.
Cardinals have lost 20 games or something, haven't they?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Maybe more than 20.
They're somewhere around there.
Laura Caldwell, my friend Laura Caldwell, the author, the attorney, and the woman who works with exonerated prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
She's got some stuff to talk about. We'll be on after 9. And then another big shot senator, Senator Barbara Boxer. So, you know, for those of you who think I'm a nut job right wing lunatic, we've got McConnell on. For those of you who think I'm some nut job left wing nut job, we got Barbara Boxer on. So you go ahead, try to figure it out.
You're middle of the road.
I just want something to work.
Uh-huh.
And Jen Weigel will be in later. Jen's got a couple of shows to plug, so that's all coming up. At 6:14, this is show number 662, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. At Cochran Show on Twitter, Facebook.com/Steve Cochran Show, and 312-981-7200 is the telephone number to call up and say, "Hey, Steve," and they'll say, "What?" And then you'll pass on your information, and we got some prizes and stuff to give away today as well. A couple of people texting in about the state owing them money. My doctor is owed money. This is an 847 texter. My doctor is owed money, and I just got a final notice. The money from the state of Illinois insurance is not paying my doctor, and they now want money from me. Even though I pay my $1,900 a month premium.
I know. They're collecting. They're coming to collect.
So the doctor would like to be paid in some form by the patient, apparently. I don't quite know how that works because, you know, this is all new territory.
I don't either. I don't know. Maybe it's Medicaid? I'm not quite sure.
Could be.
It has to be a Medicaid issue.
Kankakee Community College was, this is an 815 texter. Kankakee Community College was not paid $7 million for operating expenses in fiscal 16. July 1st is the beginning of fiscal 17 in Illinois, as you know. It's one of the many colleges struggling to continue to operate. It's disgraceful. That's from Susan.
The University of Illinois, one of the most, arguably the most powerful public university in the state, which we didn't think was having problems. They sent out an email yesterday to all of the alums. Mayor, I'm sure you probably got this too.
Looking
saying,
for cash?
Well, just saying, look, this is a time we're going to have to tighten the purse strings, and it's even affecting major institutions like the University of Illinois, saying we're not going to have, you know, three different programs on Native American studies. Now we're just going to have one. Which means, of course, they don't need teachers for those,
jobs.
Well,
extrapolate that out. If you're at the University of Illinois and you're having to cut teachers for extra programs, you go to Southern or to Governor State or obviously Chicago State, which
right.
is the worst case scenario for everybody. Mm-hmm. All of these schools are suffering at a level of almost closing of the state-funded schools. And then the secondary level would probably be Illinois State and other places that got a little bit of a fallback position, but they're not going to be able to hold that end up either.
No, Western and Eastern, specifically Western, already having problems. And as you mentioned, Chicago State University, that they're in danger of not even opening. So what if you got accepted and you're about to get ready and go to school in the fall?
Well, that's the position you're in now, is that, you know, you're an 18-year-old kid. You've done the right thing. You're going to go to college in the fall. Your parents are trying to figure out, your family trying to figure out how to fund it. Mm-hmm. And I think on some level this has to go to, there's government-backed student loans, but if you try to get a private student loan, at some point the banks are going to go, well, hold on a second, we're giving you money for what?
Exactly, exactly. And MAP grants, that's a whole other discussion.
Right. So kids who are really doing a good job won't be able to get the grants they want to actually go to school. Other than that, things are going great.
If the purple ooze can turn humans into animals,
it's all, baby!
It could turn us into humans.
And we don't have to be stuck down here forever.
If there's a chance that would make us humans,
we're turtles, whether you like it or not.
Gear up, guys.
Keep the team unified, and you shall always succeed.
Here we go!
Cowabunga!
I don't know if this is such a good plan.
Don't be getting soft on me now.
And there wasn't a dry eye in the house when that line came up. We're turtles. Damn it, we're turtles, whether we like it or not. I got a soft spot. Okay, wait for the punchline. I have a soft spot for the turtles because Ross Cochran, I remember Ross, he used to work here. Ross Cochran, father to Abigail Grace Cochran, was a big Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle type. And he used to, in the family room, he used to do his Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle moves into a TV that was off because he could see his reflection. He'd practice his moves. But, I mean, that stopped when he was 18. What was he, Raphael? Raphael?
Michelangelo? Yeah. Raphael?
Not Power Rangers? Because that was big at the time.
Oh,
the
Power Rangers?
My son was a huge Power Ranger.
Yeah, the Power Rangers. Yeah, Mary, your kid's the same age as ours.
Yeah.
Ninjas.
Yeah. The key is they have to put away the uniform and the plastic sword by the time they go to college. You got to draw the line as a
not
parent.
Necessarily.
So
yeah,
oh, Steven still has
this. I'm sure it's his mother does.
Oh, all right, that's a whole other.
What do you think your wife's doing at the house now? She's dressed up, just protecting the neighborhood. Of course, all the critters you have in your neighborhood, somebody ought to have a sword.
Not a bad idea.
She probably waits till you get home.
Now we're getting into a weird area. Here's Nick. Good morning, Nick.
I like to have the words weird area said before you introduce me.
So the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, is America on the edge of their seat for this?
I don't think so. But, you know, it's going to fill a void for, you know, for kids movies for this week. You know, again, it's another comic book movie because all this stuff started with comic books. But, it just looks I don't know why, but the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the way they look now with all the CGI and they look, you know, like flawless, they kind of creep me out.
Really? You're frightened of them?
I'm a little terrified.
This is the same guy. This is the same grown man who likes the Powder Puff Girls?
Yeah. I love it's Power Puff.
Yeah, I know. I just do that for you.
How many times I got to tell you that?
I just do that for you. I remember one time I was watching Heat with the Powder Puff Girls. That was tremendous.
Uh-huh. I don't know what I have no idea what these Powder Puff Girls you are speaking of are, but
now there's
obviously it's the big one. It's the big movie that they hope will make as much, if not more, than the X-Men movie made. I just don't see it. I just don't see it making the kind of money that the last couple of weeks of comic book movies have made. But they did some counter programming this week.
What's the counter programming?
Well, there's a small, modestly budgeted sort of British chick flick that came out this week based on what I guess is a pretty big novel called Me Before You.
Yeah, they're running a ton of promos.
Yeah, and it stars one of the ladies from Game of Thrones, one of the women from Game of Thrones, and she plays a woman who is the caretaker of a guy who was recently in an accident and has become paralyzed, and he hates the world, and she loves the world, and it's about her trying to make him love the world and love her, and him trying to get over his hatred of the world. And it's exactly the kind of movie that someone who doesn't want to see stuff blow up will go see. So it'll be interesting to see if it grabs the female audience and if people go and see it over the weekend.
And Andy Samberg, who looks like Adam Sandler but actually isn't, Andy Samberg has a movie out this week, which I think is going to be, if you're an SNL fan or an Andy Samberg fan, it's probably going to be a home run. It's got some great cameos in it.
It's got amazing cameos. It's pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping, which is a takeoff on the stupid movie that Justin Bieber, the documentary that Justin Bieber made. And it's the Lonely Island guys. It's the three guys that really revolutionized a lot of stuff on Saturday Night Live with the introduction of the digital shorts, which became so incredibly popular and made SNL, made people change the way they watch SNL.
And Lonely Island is this sketch comedy thing they did online first, right?
Yeah, they started online. They would do videos online. And then when Andy got hired, the other two guys didn't. When Andy Samberg got hired, he convinced them to hire those two guys to help him do digital shorts. And
you know the story here, Andre? These are lifetime buddies. Andy Samberg and his two friends, they've worked together on every job.
Isn't that crazy? And yeah, they've never gotten into a fight. Oh, wait, that would be three women.
Sorry. Yeah, that would be three women, and they'd go home and yell at their men about them. But Andy Samberg and these two guys, I think they go all the way back to middle school.
They do.
They're just inseparable.
Yeah. And he brought them along. When he got the gig on SNL, he brought them along. And the one, I don't know if you guys remember, I'm sure you do if you're an SNL fan, it was about 11 years ago. It was the second digital short that they did, and it basically made YouTube, and it was called Lazy Sunday. And it was Andy Samberg and Chris Parnell rapping about how they were going to go see the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, very funny. Very funny. And also, the other one that was over the top that blew up all over, and it was, I think it was a mutual release, was D in a Box with Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, D in a Box with Justin Timberlake. By that point, it had been established that the digital shorts were taken off, and Lorne Michaels was basically giving the guys creative free reign to do what they wanted to do. But it was essentially, this is my experience too, Lazy Sunday made YouTube. It made YouTube, and it literally changed the way people watched SNL. And SNL, as the months and years progressed, because these digital shorts were going so well, SNL realized that what they needed to do was acknowledge the fact that not a lot of people were watching it on Saturday night, but were watching it on their computers the next day, or on Monday, or on Tuesday. And that's when it became, when they would chop it up into 3 or 4 minute segments and put it online, and that's how so many people watch SNL now. And these guys revolutionized that and embraced the technology. And they're also very funny. And, you're right, Steve. There are a million funny cameos. And, well, I don't know if they're funny. I haven't seen the movie. But there are a million funny people who make cameos.
Well, point being, it says something about Andy Samberg because a lot of people wanted to do this with him. We got like a minute here, but I want to give you time to plug your Tuesday screening.
Yeah, very excited about it. It's the Feel Old, Get Ready to Feel Old. It's the 35th anniversary of Raiders of the Lost Ark. 35th anniversary.
How about that?
It's insane. So I'm screening it on the big screen, digitally remastered. If you've never seen Raiders on the big screen, it's an incredible experience. The tickets are going really well, so if you want to get in there, you should reserve your seats now at moviecode.com. It's only $10. Parking is free, and it's Raiders of the Lost Ark on the big screen, digitally remastered. And go to moviecode.com, get your tickets. I'll introduce it. We'll talk about it afterwards. We had a great turnout for Risky Business last month. We're going to have a great turnout for this one. I hope everybody can make it. And then, again, in July, I'm expecting some people from the morning crew to come out because it's time to show Airplane.
Yes. So I think we should, honestly, we should all be there to support Nick, group outing.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
What's the date on that again?
I'm going to get a giant hotel suite out in Rosemont for all of us.
Good.
One hotel suite.
Where will you guys all stay?
It's going to be we're doing it the second weekend or the second Tuesday in July to stay away from, because, July 4th around that area, a lot of people are taking vacations. So we're going to do it. I think it's going to be July 12th.
Oh, I'm July on vacation. 12th.
Well,
darn
change
it.
Your vacation. It's 6:29 at Nick D Show and Nick DiGilio getting it done every night, of course, between 2 and 5 in the morning, leading into Grzanich and the Grzanich Dance Club. And then we're here at 6. Thank you, Nick. Back with the big story next on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
Is it fair to say, then, if you don't win California, you believe your campaign is over?
No, that's what you said. I didn't say. What I said is, obviously, California is very, very important. 475 superdelegates. Obviously, if we don't do well in California, it will make our path much, much harder. No question about it. But I think we have a good chance to win in California, maybe win big.
It's going to be hard for you to convince Democrats to go with you without a California victory. Fair?
Hey, look, Chuck, California is the big enchilada, so to speak. California,
here we come. Chuck Todd holding everybody's feet to the fire so you don't have to. Get it done every Sunday morning on Meet the Press, special time in Chicago this weekend. We'll tell you about that coming up. As Chuck joins us now, is Bernie delusional? Is there an end game here, or does he truly believe that he could still figure a way out to win this?
I felt like, and it depends on, I think, today with Bernie these days, I'll be honest with you, but I felt like the totality of the interview I had with him, that was a Bernie Sanders that was setting realistic expectations, meaning I think he is, if he lives by the rule that he set, he's right. California, if he wins and wins big, then he's got a rationale. If he doesn't, it's over. Now, he didn't say it that way.
But that's the translation, right? Well, that is the translation.
He implied it, which, by the way, if you're the Clinton campaign, you're actually pleased that he's put it in those terms.
Right.
He basically said, hey, look, if I lose, I've tried everything. So, look, it's going to be close. I think she has the advantage out there. I think if you look at it, was interesting. The biggest red flag in our poll for Sanders was the fact that even though it was basically a margin of error race, among people who have voted by mail or already voted, she led by 17 points. She's banking more vote. This has been a pattern throughout the primary season, is that she overperforms her poll in the most competitive races with him, because they've done more of the legwork of absentee ballots and mail-in ballots. So I think my gut is that she wins it by somewhere between 3 and 6, and it'll basically be on the power of the work they did on the mail.
Now, on the Republican side of the equation, or the Republicans in quote side of the equation, apparently, Chuck, you, me to a lesser extent, because, technically I'm a smartass, I'm not really the media, but we're all sleazebags now. And I don't know, will I see you at the meeting?
Exactly. There's so many meetings of conspiracy meetings that I attend that, I got to keep track of them.
No, I mean the meeting of sleazebag media types.
Yeah, exactly. No. That's a separate one. Normally it's...
Okay, I didn't know. Wow, we're going to be busy.
I got a couple of others, because of my religion that people think I'm part of. There's all sorts of media conspiracies I'm involved in. I lose track of them. To me, what was missed at his press conference, I think, was more that should have been the focus and should have been the angle. I mean, look, a politician attacking the media, I mean, the minute Gutenberg invented the printed press, that started happening.
Right.
So that's not news. I think what he said, he gave us two clues on governing that he should be constantly asked about. One was this idea of attacking a federal judge. I mean, again, as if he's a sitting president of the United States, that's a constitutional crisis. That is sort of beyond the pale. That, the judiciary branch only works if the executive branch enforces the decisions of the judiciary branch. If somebody who wants to lead the executive branch is trying to call into question the judiciary branch, then we have a breakdown of the rule of law. It's one thing to erode trust in media, whatever. Okay, it's not great. And politicians that do it on purpose and purposely lie about what the media does, it's bad for democracy. But we survived that. You erode trust in the judiciary, and you got anarchy.
Well, but here's the thing, and you and I have talked about this, in my words, not yours. Money doesn't make you smart, kids. It doesn't. And Donald Trump is not educated in any of these matters of government to the point that, and Chuck, this is my opinion, I don't think he gets it. I don't think he gets the fact that that is such a dangerous comment to make.
I agree. I actually don't think he appreciates. I mean, this is, let's talk about all the different ways that we've thought politicians have tried to abuse power, potentially abuse power. Spiro Agnew never attacked the judiciary system.
Right.
Richard Nixon never attacked the judiciary system. I mean, he reacts to this judge as if it's you or I talking to him and criticizing him, right? It's just like he wants to spout off at the mouth. But again, he has a responsibility now. Right, his words influence millions of Americans in ways that hasn't happened before with him, and you've got to understand with with this nomination comes responsibility, and he clearly is not accepting it.
Mitch McConnell is going to join us in a few minutes to talk about his new book. In the meantime, I want you to all be aware that the French Open is powerful enough to move Chuck Todd to 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. So I hope you're getting a little something extra in the monthly check.
Well, you know, people love their tennis ones here. It's all right. We're up early on Sundays anyway. We can do it an hour early.
That's right. Maybe get home a little early.
That's all right. That's why God invented DVRs.
That's right. Right. You can watch Chuck in all sorts of handy forms.
Exactly.
At Chuck Todd. Thank you, my friend. Enjoy the day.
You got it, Steve. Appreciate it.
And let's get to Mary with the traffic, and then Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. And yes, we have questions. Later on, Senator Barbara Boxer from California, retiring long-term junior senator from California, will be on as well.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN.
Uh, 652. One of the most famous faces in America, he's probably laughing when I say this, is Senator Mitch McConnell from Kentucky. The Long Game is his memoir, and he joins us now. Senator, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Must be happy days in Chicago with both the White Sox and the Cubs off to such a good start.
Cubs are 21 over. Is there any sign of Armageddon outside of Washington? That's it.
It's impressive. So, maybe it'll finally happen this year.
You know, you got a great life story. You're, a kid from Kentucky who, and I find this part sort of mildly amusing, but I get it. You didn't necessarily want to grow up and play for the Cubs or play big league ball. You wanted to grow up and be the leader of the Senate, and look what happened.
Well, it was after I failed in baseball. I walked the bases full in an all-star game and gave up a home run, so I figured I needed to go in a different direction.
You know what? Well done by you. And people question your leadership? Come on. The book, again, is called The Long Game, a memoir, and add it to your list. Get a couple of copies because you're careless. You might lose one. You almost quit, didn't you? That's one of the things that jumped out at me from the book back in 2014.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a big challenge. I had a big challenge from the right in the primary, and I knew I was targeted from the left in the general, and I thought about it. But then I remembered a childhood story, which I talk about in my book, when I was being pushed around by a kid who was older and bigger than I was. My dad, who was a pretty feisty guy who had fought in World War II, was watching all that. He called me over and he said, "I want you to go over there and beat him up." And I said, "Dad, he's older than I am and he's bigger than I am." And Dad said, "I'm older than he is and bigger than he is." Given that choice, I screwed my courage up, walked across the street, beat him up and bent his glasses. And that's exactly what I was thinking about when I was considering whether I was up to one more challenge in 14. So I did stand up to him. I beat him big in the primary and the general and became the majority leader of the Senate. And that's a good lesson there for all of us when we're challenged by bullies.
If you're going to punch somebody out, I would have thought it was Harry Reid. You know, he came to work with that eye problem one day, and I thought maybe you had enough and cold cocked him.
Well, look, you know, he's rhetorically challenged. He has a tendency, I think, to say inappropriate things. Like my least favorite utterance of his was when he declared the war in Iraq lost while we still had thousands of troops in the field fighting. So we've had our differences, but he's the duly elected leader of his party, and I'm of mine, and we do have to cooperate on a variety of different things every day.
A cooperation thing. I wish there were more of it, but more on that in a second. And again, the book's called The Long Game. There's also a story in here about how McConnell got elected in high school for class president, and he basically kissed up to a lot of people. So, check that out.
I got some good endorsements from cheerleaders. That's what did it.
Yeah, nice work by you. Andrea, say hi to the senator.
Good morning, Senator. While many Republicans still deciding whether to, in fact, even endorse Donald Trump or get behind him as the Republican nominee, you did so early on last month saying that you will support Donald Trump. Why did you make that decision so early, and why are you supporting him?
Yeah, well, here's the situation. He got the most votes. You know, whether he was our first choice of the 17 people who decided to run or not, he won this thing. He got the most votes, and in our country, you get the most votes, you win. Number two, I think clearly the election of Hillary Clinton means four more years, just like the last eight. And so I think for most Americans, that's the fundamental question. Are you happy with where the country is now? Do you think this is as good as we can do? If you are, then you ought to vote for Hillary Clinton. But if you think we need to go in a different direction to get the country moving again, there's only one choice at this point. Do I like everything about Donald Trump? I don't. I don't like these ad hominem attacks on people, particularly other Republicans. But he's been duly chosen by Republican primary and caucus voters across the country. This is the choice. These candidates are both unpopular, but the American people will have to choose between them.
Well, you bring up a good point, though, because you got to work with them every day. So, and that's different than the rest of us. We just have to watch them and pull our own hair out. But taking a shot at Susana Martinez and the shots he took at Paul Ryan, this all goes to the temperament question. And what happens when you're trying to get something done and he takes shots at you because he doesn't like your idea?
Yeah, that's a part of his personality that I don't like, and I think he needs to change. I thought the attack on Susana Martinez was particularly inappropriate. She's chairman of the Republican Governors Association, done a great job out there in New Mexico, and that's a part of Donald Trump I don't care for. But look, neither of these candidates are going to win any popularity contest, but they're going to be the nominees, and so we have to choose between them.
Before we get back to a good plug for the book again, The Long Game, before I let you go, I'm absolutely confused about why you guys, why it's you in particular, why you didn't call a vote on Merrick Garland.
I'm sorry you're confused about that. You'd have to go back 80 years to find the last time a vacancy created in the middle of a presidential election year was filled. You'd have to go back to 1888 to find the last time a vacancy on the Supreme Court created in the middle of a presidential election year was confirmed by the party of the opposite the president. Joe Biden said in 92, a presidential election year, that if a vacancy had occurred that year, he wouldn't fill it.
I get all that, Senator, but here's the thing, that we have written rules and unwritten rules. You're talking about unwritten rules and maybe even tradition, and people can certainly argue those points. The written rule we have is the Constitution. And
let me talk about that.
Well, hold on a second. I'm not done.
Go ahead.
The deceased justice was a constitutionalist of the highest order. Wouldn't the legacy for him, especially considering the fact that you've got the votes, to at least be to take up the matter and not look like an obstructionist?
The issue is who ought to make the appointment. There's no obstruction here. That we have a separate responsibility. The president gets to nominate, and we get to decide whether to confirm.
But you can't decide. You can't decide to confirm if you don't take the meeting.
Who should fill the vacancy? We're in the middle of a presidential election year.
Right.
Should the current president on the way out the door make this lifetime appointment, or should the person we're in the middle of voting for right now make the appointment? That's the point.
Well, then the point. But then, does the presidential term end at 7 years, Republican or Democrat, or does it end at eight?
It doesn't. The last time the American people spoke was in November of 2014. They elected a Republican Senate. We have a separate role to play, and we believe that the next president should fill the vacancy.
Well, I understand you believe that, but isn't your job and the job of the Congress, or I should say the job of the Senate, to take this matter up in the final year? I mean, it's fine what Biden said. I don't disagree with you.
It's our job to decide how to deal with it because we're in the majority and we have a separate responsibility.
But honestly, Senator, do you truly believe you don't have any damage as far as image goes to moderate Republicans or moderate Democrats when it comes to down ballot races and the control of the Senate going forward? If the image of the Senate is even having the votes to deny, won't even listen to this?
I couldn't disagree with you more. The American people understand that the nomination ought to be made by the person there in the.
I think this is one you got to get outside of the beltway on.
Disagree on this. We just disagree on it.
Yeah. Well, listen. I agree with you. We disagree, and I just hope at some point that you guys will get together and see the wisdom of at least sitting down and taking the vote because you have the control. Now, having said all that, we're not fighting here, Senator, because I respect what you've done and what you continue to do and the fact that you didn't kill Harry Reid in the time you were with him. The book is called The Long Game, a memoir from Senator Mitch McConnell. It's out and available everywhere, and I hope you have a good day.
Thank you.
See ya. It's 6:59. We'll come back with the news in a moment on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
This is just more evidence that Donald Trump himself is a fraud. He is trying to scam America the way he scammed all those people at Trump U.
I'll win the Trump University case. I could settle that case. I could have settled it. I just choose not to.
Senator, Secretary of State, First Lady Hillary Clinton, she's not wrong about the fraud thing, but man, we got to get her a pot and a kettle. I think going down the dishonesty road is going to be a tough path for her. Wouldn't it be great if the rest of the campaign, they both had to be hooked up to lie detectors the entire time? They'd sound like human fax machines. Just be going off for weeks. It's a 7:14. Eric Adelson in a moment. Rick Pearson coming up. Pat Brady's about to tee off in the Jared Payton golf outing this morning. And couldn't be bothered to come in because he's helping Jarrett's foundation. You know, I got to say, I think you made the right call.
I miss you, buddy. I wish you were out here with me. It's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day, even though I know that's not what you said off the air. all right, so you're the perfect guy to ask this question. And a bunch of very nice texts coming in. But, you know, I don't think I asked Mitch McConnell anything unfair, did I?
No, you were very fair with him, but he has such a terribly unpopular position. It doesn't make any sense. All he had to do is let it have an up or down vote, let the process go through, and this guy doesn't get confirmed, but instead they stepped out before Scalia's body wasn't even back to D.C., and he said no hearing. And the only one and the first person that did it was Mark Kirk, said, you know, this is not the right way to do it. I thought you were very fair, but I tell you, listening to him and that 40% of the moderates that we need to get to win elections as Republicans, you listen to him and you just want to strangle him.
Yeah, because I do think he's that delusional. I think he thinks that the inside the beltway thing transfers to outside the beltway. Outside of the far right on this issue, there's nobody that can understand why the Republicans wouldn't call a vote, have the hearing, and call a vote when you have the votes to turn down the nominee.
There's a million ways to kill a nominee. It made no sense to step out like he did. I thought your interview was great, and you kept asking. I thought he was going to hang up there for a second, but
I don't think we're going to get a lunch. I don't think Mitch and I are going to get a lunch.
Maybe but coffee. Asked,
oh, I forgot. I'm cool with that.
You asked exact right questions, and it's an indefensible position, I think. And it was apparent from his responses he doesn't have a good defense.
Well, the unfortunate thing is Senator McConnell put me in a bad position because he puts me in a position of defending Donald Trump, which is not my favorite spot, as you know. But I don't know how, as the Senate Majority Leader, you call out Donald Trump for making dangerous comments about a federal judge, and 2 minutes later you have no answers for me on how you are damaging the Supreme Court. I mean, it just those two things just don't connect.
Yeah, a lot of these guys, in his defense a little bit, a lot of the elected officials at the highest level are caught in a really bad spot with Trump, just having to defend him, basically not defending him as the nominee, but we got to protect down ticket. I think that's the tack everybody's going to take. You've seen this in the last couple of days. Some real Trump critics are now taking that line. I don't like it. I'm never voting for him, but that's the line they're taking right now.
What time's your tea time?
8 o'clock. Hop in the car. Just give it to Dave.
Dave and Andre can take over right now.
I'll get you on.
We'll get Eric Adelson in here in a moment and Rick Pearson as well. Go hit some balls. We'll come back to you in a few minutes here.
Okay.
All right, 7:16. It's a traffic update time, and Mary Vandeveld is here with the update. Mary, apparently the audience wants us to be more careful in how we're pronouncing your name. It's still Vandeveld, isn't it?
Yes, there is a D at the end. Well,
so
there's an E at the end,
too. Vandeveldi?
No,
mm-hmm.
Even though some people do say that.
It's not Vandevalve?
Vandevalve? No, and it's not Vanderbilt. I always get
it's
that.
It's not Vandeveld.
I wish it was.
And it's not VD.
It is VD, but that was her call.
It's VDV,
right.
Actually, because there's three capitals.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
The governor this morning suggested that we all work together on a stopgap measure that would take us through the general election, through the veto session, maybe into January. This is not something that's going to happen today. It's going to be sent off to the budget working group. These are the people that have worked on the budget for a year and a half.
It's 7:22. Eric Adelson joins us. Rick Pearson in just a second. I believe Rick Pearson's at the Lincoln Library. That was Mike Madigan. Mike Madigan can move mountains in 45 minutes. Why couldn't he and Cullerton agree to a stopgap budget by midnight the other day? And hi, by the way. How are you?
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, I don't know that he can move mountains that quickly. I think you give him a little more credit than he's due. Second of all, I think they were all surprised that, you know, not surprisingly, the governor has no consistent position, who said for weeks leading up to that day, no stopgap, no Band-Aid, we're not governing that way, I won't do it. And then that morning turned around and said, hey, let's do a stopgap, let's do a Band-Aid. And
yeah, but why not do that when you have someone who's intractable and won't change?
I understand, but I'm saying it was so surprising because the governor for months said he would never sign that. He wouldn't do that, so they weren't even working on one. And then all of a sudden that morning to say, let's do one, I don't think you can just spit it out that day. So I think, you know, Madigan's an easy punching bag in this, but again, the governor's the leader.
But don't you think he's earned it?
No.
You really don't. I mean, Cullerton's been, you know, I love you, but Cullerton's been there almost 40 years.
Yep.
Madigan's been there more than 40 years.
Yes.
How are they not part of the problem?
But let's talk about this. Last week, the governor, this is the height of chutzpah. That's a term of art. He stood up and he said he blamed the Democrats for Illinois now has the highest unemployment rate. I'm pretty sure in the last 30 or 40 years, Illinois never had the highest unemployment rate. There's one variable in this. Since he became governor, Illinois now has the highest unemployment rate. That's squarely on his shoulders. Yes, equal opportunity blame. There's obstruction and all that. But Illinois has never been in a worse position today, and the difference is Governor Rauner.
But what if you put somebody else in the governor's chair? How will Mike Madigan act differently?
I think he passed a budget months and months ago. I know Pat and others said it was out of whack. But the governor has a mandatory veto power. He could work on it. He could adjust it.
A mandatory veto power at $3.5 billion is $4 billion less than this one. My point is, I don't understand what Madigan's doing other than trying to embarrass or damage the governor, because he knows better than anybody, $7.5 billion, he's never going to get anything close to that.
But I understand, but also the idea of let's compromise for compromise's sake, I know we all want to move it forward, we want schools to open, but there are principles you want to stand on, like allowing people to collectively bargain, like saying right to work is not something that's ultimately good for Illinois. And the governor up until this point has said, you know, that's a line in the sand, and I'm not going to pass anything unless you give up on these middle-class principles. And the speaker, rightly, I believe, has said, there's no way I'm doing that.
Let me go to Rick Pearson, who's with Abraham Lincoln. And I think he and Lincoln might be able to solve this morning. Are you with the former president at this time?
Yes, I'm having a seance. and unfortunately, he has no wisdom to offer on this.
You know why? Because he's doing this with his hands. I want no part of this. At the Lincoln Library, for what reason? Or the Lincoln Museum, I should say.
Actually, I'm at the Abraham Lincoln Hotel, not the library.
Oh, that's
very nice of you to think that I'm actually so studious I'm at the library this early.
No, I thought that maybe there was an appearance by the governor or something that you were in the coverage loop on. So that's what I assumed. I jumped to an assumption. I apologize.
No, I am just getting ready to finally leave Springfield. And, you know, it's as Eric said, you know, you've got both sides to blame here.
But sure, absolutely.
But one interesting thing is that in offering to do a stopgap short-term budget, you do have the governor now dropping his demands for what he calls his turnaround agenda, which is at the heart of this, you know, nearly year-long impasse. So that is one interesting sign. But that having been said, you come off the end of session, the governor talking compromise, but then starts a road tour where it's back into campaign mode. It's the Democrats do this, the Democrats do this. Rank-and-file Democrats break from your leaders. You're downstate. Rank-and-file Democrats downstate. You're just funneling money to the Chicago political machine. I don't know how that helps move anybody.
Totally agree.
Getting a compromise.
No, totally agree. The talk should be away from microphones. In regards to these two, Madigan's good at avoiding microphones. Rauner ought to be better at it.
Well, I just don't know why you have to start playing the regionalism game right now. I mean, the regionalism game is always done in politics, but is this the way you come out of Springfield? I mean, truly, you know, Rauner did get an unexpected victory here. The fact that you were talking for the first time about lack of unity in the Democratic ranks is something we haven't seen since Rauner became governor. In fact, Rauner, you could argue, helped create more unity for a large part in the Democratic ranks. But I just don't understand about the regionalism part at this stage.
Well, I think at some point the game passes everybody by, and I'm wondering if Mike Madigan doesn't stand up and go at some point if somebody look him in the eye and go, it's over. Because are you going to burn the Democratic Party to the ground for the sake of protecting the right to collective bargaining and unions, if those are the two main sticking points still? We're not even talking about pensions and things like that and the incredible unfunded debt we have. But the fact of the matter is, I'm a union member. Most of my friends are union members. I believe and probably run unions and the power of unions, but they are not everybody in this state. And when we get to this fall, when kids aren't going to school, if you think people who aren't union members are going to sit around and try to protect their union members just for that principle, they're out of their minds.
Well, I think there's obviously a great dare game going on, particularly involving schools. But the question is, right now, you have each side thinking the other side is going to wear the jacket for it if schools don't open. And as long as you have that belief, there's no motivation for compromise.
And that's leadership in 2016.
Well, that's politics in 2016. It's winner take all. This is not the Illinois I signed up to cover 30 years ago as a reporter. When you had statesmanship, you had compromise, you had people who knew that there was a goal to do the right thing. Now this is, and again, it's both sides. It's winner-take-all politics.
City's piece of this would be what at this point?
Pardon me?
The city's piece of this and the mayor's piece of this are what right now?
Well, you have Forrest Claypool saying if there is no education appropriation sign, city schools don't open.
And by the way, that can't wait until September or August. That needs to be handled more quickly than that because there's preparation time and things that schools need to do in the summer that they won't be doing if nobody's coming to school.
Right, but that's huge right there. And a lot of schools obviously, as you said, doing their planning, but some schools in wealthier districts, less dependent on state funds, they can open and stay open a little while. They have reserve funds that they can tap into, but school districts that serve a large number of students from lower income families, more heavily dependent on state funding, they won't open their doors this fall.
All right, last thing before I let you go, because we get this question literally every day, multiple times, and I'm sure people say the same thing to you. It's not just me that's upset with Madigan. It's not just me that's upset with the entire process. People are getting on board with this and connecting to how big a damage, how much damage is being caused. But the question we get over and over again is, why can't Madigan be fired? Why can't he be pulled out of the position of power he's in? How does he stay in office? Why do people keep voting for him? Take any of those.
Well, number one, it's the members who elect the speaker, okay? And so it's the Democratic majority members who elect the speaker. And the speaker obviously amasses a great deal of power, operates the fundraising for a lot of the members. So it's kind of Mike Madigan helps elect Democratic members. He asked for one vote and one vote only, vote for me for speaker.
Do you, I can't ask you this because you're my friend Rick Pearson, but I can ask Eric. Eric, do you truly believe that Mike Madigan cares more about the people of Illinois than he does about his power base and staying in office?
I do. I think he believes in the institution of the General Assembly. I think he has shown over his career that he believes that you can work with governors when it's appropriate, but there's certain principles he's going to stand on. And look, I understand that you have a very strong opinion about him. I think it's misguided to simply point the finger at him and say he's the reason there's a stalemate. I think the reason is the guy sitting in the big chair, and if he had not demanded these sort of outrageous turnaround agenda things that had nothing to do with budget, this thing would have been solved a long time ago.
So you don't believe Madigan needs a governor he can control?
No, I don't at all.
Okay.
I mean, did he control Jim Thompson or Jim Edgar? But he worked with those guys. He got things done.
Oh, I think the power base thing and the political climate in this country in the last 10 years is way different than it was then.
I understand.
So, look, I was fighting with McConnell. Now I'm fighting with Edelstein.
I know.
What the hell? I can't get along with anybody.
I'll still have coffee with you, though.
That's good. Are we playing golf? Oh, no, that looks like that's over. Either that or I'm up first because he just said I'm number one. Stand by. More with Eric Edelstein coming up with Connect with Pat Brady as well. And Rick at Rap 30 and Sunday morning at 7 on what show?
On the Sunday Spin.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chicago Tribune and ChicagoTribune.com. We'll come back, get your big story next.
The Steve Cochran Show.
The one thing I can promise you is if we turn against each other based on divisions of race or religion. If we fall for, you know, a bunch of okie doke, just because it sounds funny or the tweets are provocative, then we're not going to build on the progress that we've started.
Say my name. Aren't you waiting for somebody to yell, say my name, and it's Trump from the back of the room? I just feel like the president, and there's certain, again, unwritten rules, like we talked about last hour. Eric Adelstein's here. There's certain unwritten rules and protocol and things that people who have the job actually respect the job. At some point, though, he's going to lose it, and he's just going to just scream into the camera. Don't you people get it? He's a dangerous, crazy man.
I'm not sure what the okie doke means, but obviously it means something. It's a remarkable piece of audio. I mean, a sitting United States president who's flabbergasted, who's basically saying, I'm speechless at this spectacle that's going on, which I think, you know, is pretty much where most of the American people are. But you hear it coming from the president, it's pretty remarkable.
Historians look back on this and wonder what happened. But also, if Hillary Clinton wasn't such a terrible candidate and didn't have the dislikes she'd have, would Trump be possible?
Well,
in other words, if you take, I don't know, give me a more popular Democrat.
Well, I don't think whatever was happening on the Democrat side had nothing to do with what happened on the Republican side. So, sure, he could still have emerged out of the Republican.
Separate stories. But I'm saying now that we are in the general, he legitimately has a shot at this. Even if you look at the electoral map, the fact that you're one of two people means you have a shot.
Yes.
And not even the Dumb and Dumber odds where you're saying there's a chance.
Right.
He has a shot. So I just think her unpopularity and her numbers and her own self-destructive tendencies are just, I mean, it's perfect timing for Trump.
Well, there's no question, you know, you're going to have two people with the highest unfavorable ratings, negative ratings of any two major party candidates. What I would say is I do think that he won't win. I don't think ultimately it will be all that close. I think you're going to have a lot of bedwetting and hand-wringing and looking at these public polls. But I think once the Sanders thing is behind and the Democratic vote is consolidated, which it's not right now, I mean, yes, her numbers are negative, but compared to his, there's nothing in it, nothing we see like it. And I think the interesting strategic debate now, and this is what's going on in Democratic circles, is why criticize him? Because... And again, I'm not taking a side.
Just let him talk.
Number one, let him talk. Number two, his negatives are 70%. You're not going to drive him higher. I mean, some of this is a math problem. There's 30% that are never going to hate him. So why continue to talk about what an idiot, moron, racist, misogynistic clown he is versus giving out a positive vision and who you are and begin to try to repair yourself? I think that's a big debate that's going to go on in the Clinton campaign, and it's a legitimate one because we always say in politics, once you've driven somebody's negatives up so high, they're not going to go any higher.
I completely agree. Hillary had a comment the other day, and she said she was talking all about Trump. He wants to build a wall.
She did it again
he
yesterday.
Wants to... Okay, you know what? Really, I am to a point of where I agree with you, Eric, because I think she's going to win California, and I don't think it's going to be close. But I don't know if you agree with that or
not. I do agree. Yeah,
but
I think so.
But clearly, you know, she should focus on herself and her campaign, pick a platform, talk about education reform, talk about ISIS, you know, international issues, not rephrasing everything that he's already said that is already a negative against
him. There's got to be somebody, you're both right, because there's got to be somebody in this campaign who's sitting down with her and goes, honestly, Hillary, can I call you Hillary? Hillary, you got to get off Trump.
Yeah.
But how does it work inside, in the back room? Who determines what speech goes out with her?
Well, ultimately, it's the candidate. And ultimately, she's in charge, and it's her show. And I say that all the time in campaigns. You know, we're just sort of along for the ride. We get too much credit. The handlers, consultants get too much credit when you win, too much blame when you lose. We play at the margins. It's her show. She's in charge. She'll ultimately make that decision. The problem in Clinton land is there's so many pockets of opinion and strong opinion. You know, you have the people from the original Clinton White House, and you have the Secretary of State people, then you have the Senate people, then you have her old Chicago crew, and then you have the people from the 08 campaign. And there's just a lot of centers of power.
So who has her ear?
I think there's a bunch of people. I think she casts a wide net. I think she likes to get wide opinions, but ultimately she's her own decider, to use
I guess it'd be
term.
Their ear. She has her own ears. But you know what I'm saying.
She has her own ears. Yes.
But the person she would listen to most, because, I, you know, call me crazy, I have a sense it's not Bill.
I'd be speculating. I do think his opinion matters. I think it should. It matters a lot, and he's as savvy a political operative as maybe this country's ever produced. So I think it'd be folly not to listen to him. But, you know, look, by her own admission, we talked about on the show, she's not the greatest politician. It's not natural for her. I think a lot of people have said, well, just become more natural, you know, drop the sort of facade. And like she was on your show talking about being a grandparent, where I've heard her in other situations talking about her early days and doing stuff with people who couldn't afford lawyers and starting legal clinics.
Well, that's the thing, right? And I want to take this up with you when we come back, because we're spending extra time with Hillary and Bernie here, because that's all we have. We've got a race. We've got one race, and it's Hillary and Bernie, and it's barely a race. But this California thing is big news for obvious reasons. And you have unique perspective, Eric Edelstein, on how this stuff gets done. So this lack of an aspirational message and this lack of focus on a real message on, A, why do you want the job? Why is it important to you? And without the generalities. I just elucidate on that in a bit, if you would. And I don't use the word elucidate very often.
I'll look it up.
And let this great state, this progressive state, tell the world you are going to help lead us into the political revolution. Thank you all very much.
Oh, Bernie, I told Hillary to stop yelling. Bernie needs to stop yelling as well. The microphone works, kids. Before we get to the gelling of a message for Hillary, you brought up something off the air a second ago about Bernie.
Well, I was just wondering, Bernie, Hillary is going to clinch the nomination, possibly before California, but I think she'll win California. She's certainly going to clinch the nomination. What happens to Bernie? I don't see him becoming a Chris Christie, walking around, going to campaign events with Hillary, or do you see that? I mean, do you see him going away, or do you see him putting up a unified front and actually campaigning for her?
Hold on a second. Your microphone might work. There you go.
It's a great question. I don't have the answer. I think that, you know, the egos get bruised. Anybody who thinks they can be president and runs, you know, obviously has a high self-esteem and feeling of themselves, and they always think they could be better than the other. I think it's hard to then, you know, make your ego secondary to somebody else. I think he'll say all the right things and do them. But look, here's a guy who's been in the wilderness his whole life. He's sort of been a lone wolf. He hasn't worked well with anybody in Congress. He's kind of been his own guy, given his message. He's not exactly a team player. And I don't say that disrespectfully. It's just a fact of life. So, but I do think a lot of what's more important so much than how he behaves is how his supporters do. And I think those feelings will feel better. And ultimately, an election's a choice. The choice is going to be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And I think that does a lot to bring people back to the fold.
Do you think the libertarian piece is a big enough piece to, you know, create a problem here? And if so, are they all going to be Republican votes?
There will be a huge other in this. I think there will be a double-digit vote for other in this election. It's a question of who does it hurt more. I think conventional wisdom is it hurts Trump. It hurts the Republicans. But, you know, you could argue that there will be Sanders supporters who are bruised and don't want to vote for Hillary or Trump and will do that. So
the libertarian, I got to tell you something. The libertarian ticket, based on executive experience, is pretty impressive.
Although I think it'd be better if Weld were on the top of that ticket than Johnson. And then you have William Kristol, who is still saying there's going to be an independent candidate who's a serious candidate. So I don't think.
But he brought up David. There's this guy named David French. And if you haven't heard of him, it's good because no one has. David French is a writer for one of the conservative monthlies, National Review, maybe. I'm not even sure. But, you know, a hardcore conservative and somebody who was in the short list that got leaked. And now maybe that third party candidate from the conservative side, not even a blip on the radar.
Right, right. No, that's hardly an earthquake. All I'm saying is I think there will be a large chunk of other in terms of the 125, 130 million Americans that vote in this election. And whose hide that comes out of is a great question. I do think on balance here today, it hurts Trump more than Clinton.
All right, we know where the hard right and the hard left go. The vast middle. How much is in the middle? Is it 40%?
It's probably about 40%. Look, we are still a pendulum nation where we swing back and forth, and people who identify as independent sometimes are in the Republican camp, sometimes in the Democratic camp. What we are seeing is lower and lower identification with both major parties, and then you do have this kind of large middle.
And it's probably a larger middle this year because of the negatives on the candidates?
That's right. And I think less people wanting to self-identify and with the particular parties, particularly how negative it is. So,
again, keeping in mind we're talking about Hillary and Bernie here, does she need to be concerned about that when it comes to a running mate more than she might be otherwise?
Yeah, I think
she wouldn't pick necessarily a hard lefty as a running mate.
I don't think she would. I think she's playing to that larger middle. And look, ultimately, I think her instincts as a political person are kind of conservative. I don't think she's going to take huge risks. I don't think she feels like it. And look, she's the pathbreaker. She's the one that is the history maker. And so I don't think there's a compelling reason to have something that's a really unique ticket. She is the unique ticket.
It probably won't be Anthony Weiner.
I heard he is not on the...
Not on the short list.
Short list.
I was trying to set you up, man.
I can't even do that.
I was trying to set you up.
Sorry,
I was trying to set you up.
Can't do it.
Before we go, the other thing we were talking about in the break, which is interesting, and I think you brought this up. Mm-hmm. How many female senators have we had from the state of Illinois?
Well, we were talking about Barbara Boxer because she is obviously groundbreaking. She's on in the 9 o'clock hour, and she was one of two female senators from the state of California, the first state to have two female senators. Illinois. I said to Eric, I know we had Kara Mosley Braun. Did we have any other women? Illinois is almost 200 years old.
That's right.
We've had one female senator.
Correct.
Is there one that jumps to mind outside of Braun that would even made a serious threat?
Well, Lynn Martin ran against Paul Simon and got crushed. Everyone thought she would have a good chance. It wasn't even close. But this is an Illinois problem, but it's a national problem. There's something called the Goldberg paradigm, which says it's very hard for women running for office to seem likable and competent. Right. For a man, you're assumed to be competent. Mm-hmm. A woman has to demonstrate that she's competent, and in so doing, becomes harder to be likable. It's a total hypocrisy,
right.
Sexist.
Because you
thing.
Don't want her coming off then as too aggressive.
That's right.
If a man's aggressive, he's powerful. If a woman's aggressive, she's bitchy.
Correct. Right. And that's been a huge challenge, and it remains a challenge. And I know it's easy to beat up on Hillary and all that and say, oh, shrill and all this kind of stuff. But a lot of that is kind of sexist talk. I'm not... diminishing
her.
Right.
No, but I can
say
something. When I bring it up, I'm not bringing it up from a sexist standpoint. I'm bringing it up from a strategic standpoint.
Totally get it. But it is a double standard for women. It is hard to seem competent and likable, and I think that's a Hillary Clinton problem. I think she does better. See, the challenge is for her and any candidate running is people are so cynical. Give them a motivation for why you do what you do. If you don't tell them, here's what motivates me in my life. Like, there's a story, a quick story in Hillary's autobiography where she says she wrote to NASA to be an astronaut when mm-hmm. she was a kid. Mm-hmm. And her dad had told her, you can do anything you want in the world. You're a middle-class girl in America. NASA wrote back and says, girls can't be astronauts. Now, that's a motivating story for a young woman to say.
It's a great story.
The nation told me I couldn't do anything. Well, I'm going to show them. Like, that says to people, oh, she's not just some power-hungry, you know, manipulative sure. Paul. That's a motivating thing for a young woman.
Why aren't more of those coming out?
Right. Well, she wrote the autobiography. It was in her story. So
yeah, but I'm saying, why isn't somebody in her world going, tell that story. Talk about your grandkid the way you talked about your grandkid to me.
Right.
Talk about your life. She's lived an entire life because people, you know, it may be fair or unfair, but it's completely understandable why people have an image problem with her. So address it honestly like a human being and get off that political
right.
talking point.
Talk
nonsense.
About her as Hillary the person. As
yeah.
opposed to the political figure that people know her as.
Well, this is a long campaign. It's already been long. I do believe she'll find her voice in this general election, and I hope we'll hear more of that.
Would you like to hear more of Trump? Are you good?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Eric Adelstein, where do you work?
AL Media.
And would you like us to follow you on social media?
Sure. I'll try to tweet a little bit more than I have been in the past. It's
you
Adel64.
You tweeted in 2007?
I did. That's true.
Adel67, you said?
Adel64.
Adel64, got it.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you?
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, honey. You know I love you more than what I should. Yeah.
Coming up on 8:15, let's set up our friend Dean here. And
that W thing is a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah, when you don't say W.
I'll stop my car, get out of my car, and start screaming when I hear someone.
Well, then
do.
You talk to Judy. I'm afraid of her.
I'm afraid of her, too.
Taylor Swift is available, fellas. Whitney Houston, there's an auction of her stuff, which I'm sure isn't at all tied into the exclusive Bobby Brown interview with... Was it Diane Sawyer or somebody's talking
you
to
her? So cynical.
Robin Robinson. Oprah on your grocery shelf and another Kardashian.
Not actually Oprah. It would be funny if you're going down the aisle. Paper towels, Kleenex.
You get macaroni and cheese, and you get macaroni and cheese.
There's a woman laying on the shelf.
Another Kardashian reality show is coming, which is great news for America. And Billy Joel selling his house. Dean's in charge of celebrity real estate. He'll be excited to handle that item. And Amber Heard and Johnny Depp may already be divorced. We'll get to all of that coming up. That's a busy agenda, man.
Well, you know, I got a lot of stuff to get to here. So.
Yeah, and some of it's actually legit.
I wouldn't go that far at all.
You can travel Chicago. You'll be calling his name. Oh, 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 oh. Dean Richards, the entertainment editor.
Sponsored by Wintrust Community Banks. Dean Richards live at Channel 9. You know, there's certain people that keep showing up on your morning show there on TV.
Of course.
Does Ron Onesti have a cot in the back or something?
Well, he's around town with Anna. He's not actually here today.
That dude's a promoter, though,
but
isn't he?
He's whatever show he's got going on. He is like the great promoters, like Ringling Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of thing. He
relentless
shows. He brings them to town, brings them out to his Arcata Theater.
That's a great old theater. Wasn't that one of the old vaudeville circuit
theaters? It was. Yeah. It sure was. A gorgeous old theater. And who did I see there recently? I don't remember. But he brings a lot of old acts in there. You know, he brought to Chicago, he brought Sophia Loren to Chicago.
Boy, don't say that too loud if Orion hears it. He'll get in the car.
I know. This was a couple of months ago, not at his own theater, but at the Copernicus on Milwaukee, near Lawrence in Milwaukee, because I think it's a little bigger venue there. So he rented it out. He brings Sophia Loren out, and, you know, she sits and does a Q&A. It was amazing.
I got to tell you something. I've never seen Orion Verklempt or Verklempt. I wasn't here the day that Sophia Loren was in, I think on Spike Show, and Orion apparently was like a 12-year-old.
Mamma mia.
Oh, hello.
Bonjour.
Hello, Miss Loren.
Hello. Mamma mia.
Could I have a hug? 8:23, lots to talk about here. Let's get after it. Taylor Swift needs a boyfriend.
Oh, this is, you know, we haven't had a Taylor Swift breakup story in a long time. Used to be we'd have them like every 2 weeks. But she and Calvin Harris were together for 15 months. In April, in a Vogue magazine interview, she said that she's in the best, happiest relationship of her life. Don't know what happened exactly, but Us Weekly this morning is reporting that it was Calvin Harris who broke up their relationship. Sources close to them say that the relationship had just run its course. Now, Taylor Swift is famous for, you know, when she breaks up with somebody, she writes a breakup song about them. So bad news for them in their personal lives. Great news for us because we'll get a new breakup song.
Yeah, Taylor Swift. It's that old saying. We've heard it for a million years. Hell hath no fury like a Taylor Swift scorned.
Mm-hmm. Breakup songs for Harry Styles, Connor Kennedy, Jake Gyllenhaal, Taylor Lautner, Zac Efron, Eddie Redmayne, Joe Jonas, Corey Monteith, John Mayer, among others.
Why, you forgot about Bennett Wakeman.
All of those.
Taylor Swift dated all of those guys?
Not at one time.
Not at one time, but she did date all of them and wrote breakup songs about all of them.
Yeah.
And how old is she?
24?
Like 20, 21?
No, she's older than that now. She's 23, 24?
It's a lot of boyfriends, that's all I'm saying.
Well, Trampy? Trampy Taylor? Taylor Trampy? She, you know, here's the thing. You and I were talking about this the other day, Andrea. And Dean, tell me if I'm wrong about this.
Yes, you are.
All right, so let's move on. She's 26. She does more for her fan base than anybody at her level of fame that I think I've ever seen.
She does a lot, yes.
And social media in particular is helpful in that regard, but it's still time in her day and stuff she has to do. But you can imagine in every town there are children who are not doing well health-wise who reach out to her and different things. She's pretty impressive.
That little girl who lived in the Mount Greenwood
town. Oh, Emily, Emily.
Yeah, Taylor Swift called her and talked with her.
Mm-hmm. Trying to ease some of the pain in that family.
Yep.
The other side of the show business coin, of course, is the tragedy of the Whitney Houston story. And now it seems like Bobby Brown's selling her bike. What's going on?
I don't think this is Bobby Brown.
Oh, it's not.
Behind this. I think it's the Whitney Houston estate, for which Bobby Brown has nothing to do with anymore, but they are the family is saying that they wanted to give back little pieces of Whitney Houston to the fans who loved her so much. There is obviously a lot of money that's going to come out of this Whitney Houston auction, which is taking place. Heritage Auctions is putting it on. You can go to ha.com, and you'll see everything that's up for auction. But, Steve, can I tell you about a couple of the things that are going up for auction? For example, Whitney Houston's first passport that she used from on her first international tour, 1985 to the mid-90s. Opening bid right now on this is $1,000. Nobody has bid on that.
Could I use it to travel internationally?
If you want to try to pass yourself off with TSA as a young black woman, sure.
I'm an older black man, so that would be more difficult, I suppose.
Whitney Houston's MTV Video Music Award, you know, the Moon Man statue for her song, How Will I Know?
Remember when MTV played music?
I don't remember. I'm not that old. Yeah. The current bid on this now is $4,000.
Wow. I'm out on both.
One final.
I got a rule of three. I like the way you work.
Rule of three. They're a pair of Air Jordans that were given to Whitney Houston by Michael Jordan himself. Current bid on those, $10,000.
That's that whole crazy sneaker industry that's out there.
It's part of that.
Man. All right. And isn't there a Bobby Brown, Robin Robinson interview on another network?
I believe that is correct.
Yeah,
I only watch Channel 9, as you know.
I'm just trying to make a list of things I won't be seeing, so I wanted to add that to it.
If you want to know anything that Mark Sapelsa is doing, I can tell you. But other networks, other channels.
What's he doing? He's playing paddleball in his office with that rubber band attached to the ball.
Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
Oprah is going to be in my grocery store?
Yes, in a matter of speaking, this is correct. Oprah Winfrey quietly applied for a trademark for something that is going to be called Oprah's Kitchen. It is speculated that there will be hundreds of products which will be in your grocery stores, like Oprah dairy products, Oprah fish, Oprah bacon, and also specialty foods like Oprah sorbet and Oprah caviar. Not known when this will hit the stores, but look for Oprah products in your favorite stores.
And a high price point kind of thing?
Don't know. We don't know anything more right now except
Andrea, you look confused.
Well, it was weird because remember when she was on her big diet, she said she's not going to ever eat foods that are white again, meaning rice.
Would she have food racist?
Eggs. No. But everything white, like sugar, flour, you know, things that, very funny.
Carbs. The carbs.
Carbs, right, the right. Carbs, right.
Yeah.
Well, none of the things that I mentioned are
white.
Dairy, dairy, fish, bacon, sorbet, caviar. I don't know why anyone would eat caviar anyway.
I don't know why I would think milk would be.
Well, that's
white.
That's true.
I want to get to the Billy Joel Dean celebrity real estate agent segment because he gets a commission on it. But Amber Heard and Johnny Depp divorced already?
Only that a high-priced Hollywood lawyer has come forward with all the allegations that are going back and forth right now and said when all the dust settles from this, that Amber Heard is likely to take home about $10 million out of the settlement of this. No prenup, but she is entitled to half of everything Johnny Depp earned in the 15 months that they were together.
It's like a hit movie. It's like being in a hit movie.
It's like being in a hit movie. She's going to get half of all the salary, but it could go on for a lifetime because in addition to what he earns a base salary, there's royalties. There's money that comes after the fact, you know, box office money that comes later. And she's going to get a piece of all that forever.
As you know, I've only been married 7 times. But I thought the old alimony thing was if she moves on and gets married or he moves on and gets married, you're off the hook. Not so much, huh?
Apparently not. But this Hollywood lawyer is also saying it's more likely that they will just settle for one big lump sum and that'll be the end of it.
Another Kardashian reality show is coming. It's called Seriously, Another Kardashian Show?
This time, you know, I've never seen any single Kardashian show ever. I'm so proud of myself for
this. You should be proud of that. I've seen moments here and there. Moments being literally a scene before I could get to the remote.
Still one of the top rated shows.
Well, why not? With the talent that family has, why wouldn't it be?
Reality shows. But this time the reality show is going to be a spinoff with Rob Kardashian.
God.
And his new pregnant fiance,
Black China.
Black China.
Yeah.
It's going to be a 6-episode deal, and when they have the baby, Steve, there will be a special. It's going to be a special episode just based on the baby.
I'm going to add that to my list of crap I won't be watching. Now it's time for Dean Celebrity Real Estate Corner. What are you repping this week?
Let me put on my yellow blazer that I wear when for Dean Richards Celebrity Realty. My twin brother, Billy Joel, is selling his estate near Palm Beach, Florida. Steve, this is a fully furnished 8,700-square-foot home.
Good. That's what I need in Palm Beach. I like that.
Built in...
Fixer-upper?
2005. Oh, no. This is move-in.
All right.
Fully furnished main house. There's a guest house. There's an adjacent vacant lot where you could put your double wide.
Nice.
When you go there.
Do I have my own studio where I can work on my music?
I did not see a studio in my listing sheet on this.
Okay.
7 bedrooms, 7.5 bathrooms.
Ooh, I'm going to need 8 bedrooms.
A full luxury kitchen. The big downside to this, though, in order to get to the beach, you have to cross a busy road. So there is that one downside, which is why he just took $2 million off the asking price. Steve, I can
Mom, must be a long road.
I can get you Steve, I can get you this honey for $27 million.
I have right now $312 that I'm willing to pay for this property.
I'd be happy to put in a contract on
All
it for
you. Right. Glad. Just want to see it off your to-do list.
All right.
Thank you, buddy. Bye. That's Dean back with a big story next on 720 WGN.
Ryan Dempster.
Steve!
Freeman, oh, he caught it right into the palm of Dempster's glove.
Ooh, that is a little smile there from Dempster.
What would Harry say right now about this win?
Well, I gotta tell you, there's a lot of champagne in here. I haven't seen this much champagne since my wedding. We had a party just like this. It was phenomenal. Go, go!
That was outstanding.
Ryan Dempster on the 21-over-500 Chicago Cubs. And I'd mentioned this earlier today, the White Sox, hottest team in baseball for June. You know, they're 1-0. Demps joins us now. Just another year, Demps, where we may have to break up the Cubs because they're too good for the rest of the league.
Well, a lot of season, like, we don't want to peak too early, you know. We're going to get trophies for the middle of June.
I think we talked about this once. Doesn't it feel like the Tigers back in 84, though, that kind of run?
Yeah, it does feel like it. I mean, listen, that's I think the most important thing about this team is they're not content with what's happening right now. None of them could care. They all could care less what their record is right now. It's fun. It's exciting. You're happy that you are where you are, you know, but at the end of the day, it's about getting to the World Series and winning a championship. And that's what every one of these guys, they still have that sour taste in their mouth from the NLCS last year, and they're ready to go out there and try and get back there and get to the next level.
How important is Madden in that? Because, you know, again, I think we may have discussed this, but I think some of these guys are too young to know they can't be this good yet.
Yeah, well, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, there's something about being young, what they say, young and dumb, and full of gumption. They're out there just like playing their heart out every game, knowing that they're good. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with knowing you're good. There's nothing wrong with believing that you're good and knowing that you're going to go out there and win ball games. You still have to go out and execute. And I think they have a really good balance of young guys and veteran guys, and obviously a manager who gets it probably as well as anybody in baseball and brings out the best in his players. And you see that all the time. Just really, really gets the positive, good things out of a player rather than anything negative. Even in a game, there's a game that's 10-0, they lose 10-0, which doesn't happen very often. Joe will find the one positive thing in that game and preach that, and it just constantly reinforces it with his players.
Ryan Dempster on the phone. I'm getting Andrea and Dave in here. When do you guys jump in?
Demps, let's real quickly, going back to last night, I think this tells you where Cub fans are right now, where this team is a little bit. Hector Rondon was not able to pitch. He wasn't available. And Joe Maddon said later that his back had stiffened up before the game. And, of course, that creates full-scale panic because your closure's unavailable for one game. His status not certain for today. Should we be concerned about that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, you got to remember this. Those guys throw a lot. Even the games that they're constantly throwing, whether they're throwing outside work or flat ground before a game. They're warm-upping games. The next thing you know, you score two in the eighth, bottom of the eighth inning or something, or you're on the road, you score a few in the ninth. The next thing you know, it become a safe situation. Well, he's still warmed up, and I think throughout the course of the year, there's times where you just something might happen. You're playing catch. You're like, oh, I tweaked this a little bit. And it's like, all right, you're unavailable today. Somebody else is going to step up and do the job. And John Lester went ahead and started the game and saved it.
Yeah, well, because he batted in the ninth inning. And even he said he was surprised that Joe sent him up to the plate to lead off the ninth in a one-run game.
Yeah, I'm sure he was, especially with his swing. You know, and I'm not one to brag about swings. John struggles from swinging the bat. We've been working hard on it, mentally, visualizing a lot. No, all kidding aside, I think him getting a hit always was nothing to do with him hitting it. It was the fact that Joe obviously, like we saw, everybody else was seeing how well Johnny was throwing the ball and letting him go back out there and finish that game that he started. You know, after that first hitter of the game, sometimes I've had those games before the first hitter jumps on you, it takes you deep. The next thing you know, you shut the lineup down the whole rest of the game, and it puts a little spark under you, and I think that's what we saw last night.
Dems, after 23 wins in a row, the Cubs finally lost a Jake Arrieta start. Took a Dodgers one-hitter to do it. But at one point in the dugout, I saw Anthony Rizzo talking to him, and I thought, oh, no, don't talk to him, don't talk to him. Does that still go on? Do you still, if he's in a zone, or is that completely thrown out the window with this team because they're just so off the cuff?
Yeah, I think it depends on the pitcher, too. I think Jake's a pretty approachable guy throughout the course of the game. He doesn't get too superstitious as to what he think might not be able to happen. And he's definitely approachable. And in general nowadays, I think you will see that, not like you used to see it, superstition and stuff like that. It really comes down to executing pitches. And that's something that's the winning formula right there to beat Jake Arrieta, by the way. Just throw a no-hitter or a one-hitter, and you have a chance to beat him.
I'm telling you, a one-hitter, you're not a lock. You know, if it's a one hitter, he still may beat you. We were talking about pitchers and talking about hitting, and those are two things that generally don't go all that well in the same sentence. But I think every big guy in America was inspired by the fleet-footed Matt Albers last night for the Chicago White Sox, who throws a double up against the wall in the gap. Unfortunately, he doesn't have time to catch his breath because there's a wild pitch, and then scores on a sack fly. That's the most running Matt's done in his entire career.
I saw that. For someone who wasn't not fleet of foot, I had some empathy for him. It's interesting. You don't get a chance very often. And how cool is that? That you do get a chance to hit, then you get a base hit, and then you score the tying run. And after all that, you're still allowed to go back out there and finish the game and close it out. Yeah, what a cool moment to just kind of hang on your hat as a reliever. They don't, especially the American League, you're not going to get a chance to hit very often and to make a difference and actually win a ball game for your team.
Yeah,
cool.
That could be the career when it comes to the bat. Before we go, Barry Bonds made some news yesterday. And Barry Bonds, who, and everybody's got their own opinion on Barry Bonds and they're entitled to it, but I had some personal interaction with Barry Bonds and none of it was pleasant. You know, normally you deal with somebody who is a celebrity athlete or a celebrity in general. They're going to have good days and bad days like everybody else, and some are more difficult to deal with than anybody else. But I think Barry Bonds maybe deserves a little bit of credit, and I don't know that there's any other agenda here other than growing up finally, because he said yesterday I was a jerk, amongst other things he said about himself. Do you think there's some realization going on there?
Absolutely. I think I couldn't agree with you more on Barry and how he was, and I don't know if that's a persona he carried. You know, he was a little bit that way in college from what people had said, and just, putting himself, your dad's Bobby Bonds and your grandfather's Willie Mays, and maybe he felt like he had to establish some serious alpha male dominance. But he didn't treat people very nice. He treated them like they were below him, but if you got to know him and you kind of broke through that circle a little bit, I had a chance to go to Japan on an all-star tour after the 2000 season with him, and I played with him. And at first I thought exactly what you said. I thought, man, this guy's a jerk. And I did get a chance to be around him a little bit more and stand up for myself when I felt something was right. And by the end of the trip, he was giving me a big hug and it's good luck this off season, work hard. And it was a different person. I think you're seeing that now, whether it's growing up, being around guys, and now realizing how hard it is as a player for him you know, things were a little bit easier in the game just because of the natural talent he had. And I think it's great. You know, hey, everybody deserves a second chance at a lot of things in life, and being a little bit better person, I think anybody deserves a second chance at that, and good for him for making those changes.
Yeah, I think we all get older to the point where we realize, you know, I'm not nearly as big a deal as I thought I was, so maybe I need to be a little nicer to people.
Yeah, oh, for sure, absolutely. And then there's the other one, too, the one who was really nice and then just becomes an ornery, grumpy old man. So
right, that's the opposite front. Exactly, exactly. Great talking to you, Demps, and thanks for all the information you give us and the insight as well. A little homework for you. Next time we come back, I'm not going to put you on the spot now, but as a tribute to Matt Albers, next time we talk to Demps, and you guys help me remember this, I want to know the slowest runner he ever played with.
The slowest. That's good.
Because he may still be rounding the bases. There he goes, Ryan Dempster.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
910, I am a blessed guy. I have the lovely and talented Andrea Darlis, the lovely and talented Laura Caldwell, and the lovely and talented Anna DeVlantis plugging the show.
That's right, flanking you. So good to hear.
And the lovely and talented Dave Ennett.
Yes. Thank
my
you.
Main field of vision here.
Your sight line.
All right, we got a million things to talk about and no time to do it. So Laura Caldwell is here. She is a lawyer. She is an author. She is an activist for exonerated prisoners. And we got something to say about everything. But do you want to plug this deal tonight, or is that a private thing?
No, I really do. This is open to the public. And it's a book launch for a book called Exoneree Diaries. So there's an amazing journalist named Allison Flowers here from Chicago. She put together on a different radio station.
Which one? You can say it.
So Be Easy. Really good.
Are they still in business, Be Easy?
Not that. Not since Kogan left. Yeah. So she put together a great piece called Exoneree Diaries.
And I'm sure it was good.
She explored four exonerees that we've worked with, some of whom you've met, Steve. And it was so successful and so praised. And frankly, it really contributed to people knowing that wrongful convictions happen and how hard it is to start over.
So it's tonight, where and when?
Tonight at 6 to 8 at 25 East Pearson, which is Loyola Law School in Chicago. So tonight, Thursday from 6 to 8, it's open to the public. And we'd love to see everybody.
Do you think, Laura, the rate of recidivism has gone down over the years? I mean, you hear all these stories about, you know, ex-offenders and they come into the world and then they go back. But it seems that it's getting better, that rate, is it not?
Yeah, you know, well, if we're just looking at people who are exonerated and innocent, I mean, wow, people who've struggled that much really don't want to go back. However, we have seen it happen, and in large part, when it happens, it's because there was little or no support. We're trying to support Illinois exonerees who've been declared innocent, but we are only barely helping. I mean, the need is pretty vast. And so when people don't get adequate support and start to feel lost, I mean, you and I feel lost sometimes in this world.
Right.
When you've done that, though, and you have nothing to draw on from the last 20 years, it's pretty tough.
You taught me so much about this segment of life. And the amazing thing is the gratitude and the lack of anger that these exonerees have when they leave, no matter how much of their life has been stolen from them. Human nature is what it is, and I'm sure there's a roller coaster ride, good days and bad days and all of those things. But the one thing we can do as a state is provide opportunities and support, and that's what Laura Caldwell's tried to do for a long time. How is this cowardice that's gone on in Springfield and the problem in both parties affected the ability to even fund these exonerees after we've stolen their lives to at least set them up as they get out of jail?
Steve, I'm like, don't get angry often. I am very angry about this. And I've heard you talking earlier, and I'm not willing to point a finger one way or the other because I think it's super complex. But the fact of the matter is that not only is Illinois not funding all these things that we know about schools and services for this and that, there are 10 people in Illinois who have been declared innocent. They went through a whole other process to be declared innocent. We're going to give them about $200,000 each. That's it.
That's unbelievable.
And they had to go through another court process. And now
and explain how much of their lives were stolen, just in a couple of cases.
An average client does 12 years.
12 years of their life. Imagine you're improperly imprisoned for a weekend.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're going to be mad as hell and mad as hell at everybody. 12 years, that's the average.
Correct. And, you know, you pointed out the lack of anger. There is anger. And as you pointed out, I'm glad we're developing this conversation because, of course, you're right. It's roller coasters.
Sure.
They are just so good at recognizing that you and only you control your emotions. So they're pretty good at getting themselves back in the good flow of emotions. But how do we expect them to continue to do that if we can't even give them? This is a less than a $2 million one-time budget thing. And by the way, I've told you that we've passed Illinois laws for mental health for exonerees, for automatic expungement. Guess what? For education? Nothing.
None of it's being funded.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, what we've done as a state is we've failed kids with special needs. We've failed adults who need help. We failed the elderly. We failed the young. And we've failed exonerees who, you got to wrap your head around this, people, not guilty. They also were in jail and they were not guilty.
It's like triple punishment. We punish them the first time when we wrongfully accuse them, but okay, that happens. We punish them the second time when we keep them in jail. We punish them the third time when we make them beg and plead and write letters and cry. And then we punish them again when we make them go through another process to get this declaration of innocence. Now we're going to punish them another time?
The level of red tape that it has. You know what exonerees should get when they get out of jail? A check, a ride, and a house right. That we've set up for them, and a job. And we can't even do the bare minimum.
Correct. And we cannot even do the bare minimum. There was an article last week about how Innocence Projects are flailing to keep up with the demand. Guess what? There's like three after Innocence Projects in the United States. So
and you brought Amanda Knox here, which is amazing in itself. She's the, I don't want to say the poster child for perhaps women who have been wrongfully accused, spent time in prison. Hers especially so because she was overseas.
Right.
But do these names like Amanda Knox, Stephen Avery, the first time, do people kind of relate? Will that maybe resonate a little bit more because now we know their stories, there are names to put with faces, Laura?
I do think that has helped immensely. When Steve and I first started having these conversations about exonerees and who those were, those are people who are exonerated, they're innocent. We had to define everything, and I was so glad that Steve is the amazing interviewer he is because he's so good at breaking down a problem and distilling it. It's so much easier now because making a murderer. Yes, that first time Stephen Avery, we know he's innocent. We know who did it.
Right.
We know Amanda Knox is innocent. She's been exonerated by the Italian Supreme Court. The EU last week just announced that she could sue Italy. And by the way, I'm going to come back here this summer to make a special announcement about her returning this fall.
Excellent. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Excellent. She's so a great speaker.
You guys have kind of become friends, huh?
We have.
That's
and
great.
I'm really going to see if I can get her in here that morning.
I would love that because I think she has an opportunity to be a fabulous spokesperson for this. It's not the life she's chosen, but it's the life that's been, you know, chosen for her, maybe. And
exactly.
She's doing an amazing thing by talking about it on any level. It personally angers me unbelievably because we have people who come from, in large part, difficult circumstances, who are fast-tracked by crooked detectives. And it wasn't just the Burge era. You know, we've, as much of a cop backer as I am, we know that in any major police department, and in Wisconsin, in little town police departments, there's bad cops too. And they've taken advantage of these kids who come from bad situations generally, and they take away their lives. And the least we can do, if you have any humanity at all, is care about these people enough when they get out to try to help.
Yeah, it's. I think everybody in America is having a little bit of a heartbreak around police officers, frankly. In my book, Long Way Home, I declared myself a cop groupie, like, I kind of want to date a cop. I hang out at 7-Eleven because I do. I'm actually in the process of getting set up with a detective right now. Not kidding you. I'll come back to report.
I love when
that.
You work out your fetishes on the air.
I know. Remember when I picked up that other guy on the way?
Yeah, it's a long story.
You know what I'm saying. Anyway, that's the wrong terminology. But yes, I totally agree. However, we got to recognize, I mean, I do know a ton of amazing cops. Anna Devontae's uncle is a fantastic cop.
99% of cops are pure and good,
exactly.
And they risk their lives every day for us.
Rest of those 1% are really ruining it for them right now because they're not getting help on cases that they should get help on because the average citizen who's seen making a murderer is kind of like, you know what? No, thanks. I won't talk.
You're exactly
See?
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so plug the event again tonight, because if people can't be there, there's got to be some other way we can help.
Yeah, if you can come tonight, this is just a book launch that Life After Innocence and Loyola Law School is funding, and just, excuse me, not funding, just hosting. And so it's 6 to 8, 25 East Pearson. That's Loyola Law School, Chicago, 25 East Pearson, 6 to 8 tonight. Allison Flowers and four fabulous exonerees. And I think we'll even see the lovely Karen Daniel from Northwestern, who does all the hard work.
And Life After Innocence, is there a way we can fund that, make a donation? And in that regard, you know, the money's going to go to the foundation to help set these folks up?
Yeah, thank you. If you just Google Life After Innocence Donate Now, we have an online page. And we are right now in the middle of an expansion plan that will hopefully lead to regional offices and other places and really fully fund us so that we can truly start to give more consistent and fuller support to these exonerees.
Retiring legendary Senator California's Barbara Boxer will join us in a couple of minutes. We'll talk to her, and you're welcome here anytime. You know that.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Stick around if you want. Say hi to your friend Jen Weigel. She'll be here shortly. It's 919. Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own
720 WGN.
923. Barbara Boxer, Senator Barbara Boxer, is retiring from the Senate this year in California. She has a book called The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. Out and available everywhere. You should get two copies. You're careless, you'll lose the first one. And good morning, Senator. How are you?
Oh, it's very nice to be with you, Steve.
Nice to have you here. You know, I was a fan of Alan Simpson, that crazy old coot.
He was a character.
And Tom Daschle and Trent Lott were on not too long ago with their book, Crisis Point. Did part of the decision to step aside now, because you look fabulous and you're doing the work, was it because the dialogue has changed and it's so much harder to get stuff done?
No, not at all. That's just where it is, and it's a challenge, and I've stepped up to that challenge, and even though it's been very difficult because the parties have moved so far apart, I can still find the sweet spot in certain areas like infrastructure, roads, transportation, other things, after school programs, tough, but we've been able to do it. No, it's just that, you know, I've given at the office for 40 years. I've been in elected office for 40 years.
You'd like a little time for yourself? How selfish of you.
Well, you know, I'm still going to work. I love to work. I'm kind of a workaholic personality, but, you know, it's time for me to come home to California, make that my base, not have to be on those cross-country trips. And by the way, I was able to write the book, The Art of Tough, because I had so much time on an airplane. So, but I've done it. It took 3 years. I'm happy to share it with everybody. And, you know, I hope people will get something out of it.
Senator, loved your book. I want to, I didn't know you were a reporter. You started out as
a
reporter in the early 70s. And then in 76, you won your first political campaign. What made you decide to jump ship and go to the other side?
Well, it wasn't exactly that way, but that's such a good question. What happened was I ran for office first in 1972, my only losing campaign. And it was such a funny thing because it was a local office. Everyone came and asked my husband to run. He's the lawyer and the guy. And Stu said, well, how much does this job pay? It was county supervisor, $11,000 a year. And he said, I can't support my family on that. And he looked at me and he said, why don't you do it? So I ran in 72. I lost a very close race. Then I became a reporter because I knew so much about issues in the county. And then I tried again.
And it seemed like it worked out okay. Yeah. It seemed like that helped.
It worked out okay, but not without its moments, trust me.
Barbara Boxer, The Art of Tough is a book, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. I want to personally thank you for the work that you've done in the Senate. In regards to autism, I have an autistic brother. My daughter, who is one of the great people on this planet, not just fatherly pride, just finished her master's and works with kids with autism every day. How are we doing in that regard? I mean, on a state level, we got huge issues here in Illinois. But federally, are we getting any groundbreaking in regards to that?
I think what is happening, and we talk about a sweet spot, we can find support for research into these conditions that are plaguing our families. So I can be optimistic with you because I think people understand, even though they may fight about what is the role of government, Well, clearly, our families are not going to find a cure for these diseases. We have to help. So I think I'm leaving the Senate in good hands in terms of the support for research into autism and Alzheimer's and all of these conditions that are so difficult for our families.
Senator, you've been groundbreaking for women in politics and leadership in general. Here in Illinois, we were discussing earlier today, we've had one female senator in 198 years. Mm. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton making her run and has a great chance of being the first female president. Why has it taken so long?
It is a struggle for equality in our country. You know, when we started out, I just did some research on this, and George Washington ran. Only white men of property could vote, and only 6% of the population actually participated in that election. So our country is a history of broadening the participation. But it is a struggle, you know. It is a struggle, and there's been bloodshed over it. And now we see voter suppression. Now, women didn't get the right to vote till 1920. And wouldn't it be something if we had the first woman president there in 2020 when we celebrated that 100th anniversary? But people don't realize that suffragettes who fought so hard were actually put in prison and force-fed. And that was under Woodrow Wilson, because he did not like the fact that the women were agitating for the vote during World War One. He didn't want that diversion. And
that's less than 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a mighty struggle. And in my book, The Art of Tough, I talk about what it's like, what it was like for me to go door to door. I'll tell you one quick story. It's in the book where I knocked on the door, was trying to get votes for that first losing campaign. A woman behind the door said, "Who is it?" I said, "Barbara Boxer, I'm running for supervisor." So she opens the door. The first thing she does, she looks down and she said, "I didn't think you'd be so short." Then the next thing she says is, "I can't possibly vote for you. You have 4 children. You're leaving at home."
Wow.
So this was a part-time job, 7 minutes from my house. And I said, "I only have 2 children." She said, "No, you don't. You have 4. She starts arguing that she had read that I had 4 kids. So finally I said, "Lady, I gave birth twice. I'll never forget it." I said, and I realized at that point I could stop a missile with my hand from hitting her house. That was the end of it. But that was the type of prejudice that I faced and that women faced in those early years.
Well, regardless of your party affiliation, I hope you get some inspiration out of Barbara Boxer's book if you're a female and have any interest in the political process, because, you know, we live in a difficult time here. Because you got a couple of candidates with high dislikes here and people who are really skeptical about the process. And we need more young people to want to be involved at a time when people really want to run in the other direction. So I really hope they get your book and I hope they read it.
Steve, that is really one of the messages of the book. We could be tempted to pull the covers over our head, but it's our country and we have to make it a more perfect union. We have to partake.
All the best. I know you got a lot of folks to talk to, but I'm sure we'll cross paths soon.
I hope so, Steve.
Barbara Boxer, The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. She and Dianne Feinstein came into office in, was it 92, I think?
Yeah, I think it was 92. Right around the Kira Mosley-Braun. Yeah,
and it was called The Year of the Woman.
Yeah.
Well, the Year of the Woman. Can you imagine?
1992? I know.
Yeah,
that's sad.
Yeah, the Year of the Woman. Well, thank God we haven't had to keep that up. Yeah, right. That whole Year of the Woman thing. What are you people going to want next? It's 9:30. We're back after this on 720 WGN. 9:42. Andre and I had a great night at the Chicago Theater, I don't know, a month ago? A little less than that, I guess.
A couple weeks ago. It was awesome.
When Carol Burnett came to town, and she did several shows. And took questions from the audience. One of the great segments on that show was just that open-ended Q&A. And told great, great stories and went on and on and on about how fabulous Vicki Lawrence is.
Yeah, and how they met. And Vicki sent her a fan letter. It was cool.
And Vicki, as we continue with Fabulous Women Wall to Wall, Vicki Lawrence. It's the new name of the show. Vicki Lawrence on the phone now. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. You know, Carol Burnett could not say nicer things about you if you were in the room. She was practically tearing up talking about you.
Oh, well, that's sweet.
Yeah, it was very nice. It was very nice. And
so she's actually reading what I wrote for her, huh?
Yes, she had the script. It was right there. It was handy.
Uh-huh.
The story she told, you kids with your fancy internet, remember, it's just a fad, it'll never catch on. But I want you to take you back. We told the story on the air, but this is so great, about how you were discovered. Because somebody asked about you, and she told the story. She's apparently 14 or 15 months pregnant. She's at her house.
And that's what she said, too.
Yeah, and she's catching up on her mail. And she got either a letter from you or your mom.
From me.
About Miss Firecracker? Was that it?
That was it. The Miss Firecracker pageant, right?
Fireball. Fireball.
Yeah. Okay, I got to be honest. Firecracker is a better name. So she reads the letter, and she tells her husband, the pageant's tonight. There's something about this girl. We got to go. Is that all how you remember it?
Pretty much. I was entered in this little contest, and our newspaper gal did an article about it about 2 weeks before the contest and ran a picture of me and said that I looked like Carol Burnett. So my mom said to me, it's time to write that fan letter. So I did, and I said that I would love to meet her someday, and I enclosed this little article, sent the letter off, I believe, to Carol Burnett, Hollywood, USA, something like that. I didn't have an address.
Of course not.
And, you know, it was like sending your kids sending a letter to Santa Claus. It gets there,
right.
I guess. And and it landed on her desk the day of the contest. Her secretary at the time was her cousin, and she used to call her Cuz. And Cuz said, Carol, you got to come in here and read this letter. So she reads the letter. She takes my dad's name out of the newspaper, looks us up in the phone book, calls me after school, says, I'm coming to the contest tonight, sweetie. She said, I'm really pregnant. Get me a seat way in the back. I'm going to sneak in and sneak out. And then I'll call you in a few weeks and we'll have lunch and discuss your career.
You must have lost your mind.
Well, I thought she was nuts. I thought, well, for God's sake. For God's sake. And the contest was at Hollywood Park, which is now demolished. I hate it. They're tearing it down. They're going to put that new Rams stadium there, right?
Yeah, that's too bad.
The Rams' new big stadium. But anyway, that's where it was. It was at the racetrack. And she said to her husband, we're going to this contest. He said, what the hell is she, a jockey? And she said, "Just I'm pregnant. I have this hunch. So you just come along. So, yeah, she sneaks and watches this little contest.
It's just such an amazing story to me because this is
ridiculous. It wouldn't happen nowadays.
It's a billion to one. It just doesn't happen. Yeah. Do you remember what the letter said? What the letter or the article might have said that may have caught her eye?
Well, the article said that I looked like a young Carol Burnett.
Yeah, but there had to be more than that, right?
Well, it was a talent contest, so I guess she's assuming that I must have some sort of talent. I mean, you know, honestly, because this was November of my senior year in high school, and my plan was to go to college, study dental hygiene, learn to clean teeth, marry a rich dentist, hang it up. That's what I thought I was doing.
Well, you're still hoping for that, aren't you?
Comes along, and I do have this tooth fetish, I'm just going to say. And she comes along, and I get kidnapped by show business.
That's unbelievable.
I have said many times this would never have happened without you. And she says, oh, yes, it would. It would have happened one way or the other.
Well, I mean,
how, Carol? How would this have happened?
She's very sweet.
I'm going to be in a dentist office somewhere.
You screwed up everything.
Scraping harder. How is that going to happen?
But I got to, you know, the other thing she mentioned about you is Harvey Korman, like taking you under his wing and really teaching you everything that he could and he knew as fast as
he could. Absolutely.
So I assume you loved Harvey, huh?
Well, because, you know, when I first got on the show, Harvey said to me, you know, forget stage left, stage right. He said, you can't even find the toilet. He said, so we have work to do here. And I think, you know, he was just being the team player that he was. He just set about to make me a comedian. Carol had a show to run. You know, so Carol, Tarby's really the one that took me aside and would work with me on dialects and props and, you know, characterizations.
It's such a cool story about Harvey, too, and who he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, when Mama's Family came along, when we went to do the sitcom, we were doing this Mama like from the Carol Burnett show that was very sort of strident and one dimensional and mean, and we did 2 weeks worth of shows, and I said, this is not funny, and I said, you guys have got to bring Harvey in to help me, and I said, what am I going to do, Harvey? He said, well, you've got to turn her into a sitcom character now. She's got to be silly and fun, and I said, but she's never even smiled, and Harvey said to me, what have I taught you? You are every character you do. if you, she is in your gut. Whatever you can, she can do, you can do.
Wow.
Vice versa. And she was really responsible for setting Mama free. I tell this story, and it's my husband's nightmare. He's in here making coffee right now. He just looks at me and rolls his eyes.
Well, he's just worried that you're running off with the dentist.
He's going to roll over, and he's scared he's going to roll over in bed one morning, and Mama will be there. That's what he's scared of, because Mama is me.
So he's actually thinking it's going to be easier for him if you do run off with the dentist. That's the flip. So, well, listen, I don't quite understand this PBS thing. So are we running full shows on PBS or sketches?
Oh, no, it's eight of Carol's most favorite sketches.
Okay.
And it's
like the dentist and As the Stomach Turns.
I've seen snippets of on YouTube, but now they're going to get to really watch and just laugh and have a good time. Yes, the dentist, if you had to put a Harvey and Tim sketch the time capsule, it would undoubtedly be the dentist. There is some As the Stomach Turns, because Carol was just such a soap opera junkie back in the day. And, gosh, there's Gone with the Wind, or Went with the Wind, we called it.
That's
which
my
is
favorite.
It's Went with the Wind.
One of our best movie takeoffs ever.
Went with the Wind, where Carol Burnett wears the curtain from downstairs.
And the curtain rod.
And leaves the rod in.
And the curtain rod. And I played Prissy. I will say, I think Prissy was pretty damn funny.
She was great. Yeah, she was great. You're great. Yeah. I've loved you forever, and I'm no dentist.
The family sketch. It's a bunch of fun sketches. You'll just really tune in and have a great laugh.
Watch your PBS listings coming soon. And I said I loved you forever. I'm no dentist, but just know that I'll always be there to stalk you if you need me.
Okay. All right.
Have a great weekend, and thank you for being on.
Thank you.
There you go. That's Vicki Lawrence.
She's the best. She's great. And her husband's right there making coffee. He's listening to every word you're saying.
It doesn't
Mr.
matter.
Stalker.
She's so running away with the dentist with her weird tooth thing. Jen Weigel joins us in a moment, and this is 720 WGN.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN.
Producer Sandberg's here. You gave me half a donut. It's one of the best donuts I've ever had in my life, and I'm not a donut guy. What's the story there?
I'm a donut girl, and everyone needs to listen to this. Fabulous Freddy's at 701 West 31st Street in Chicago. It's the Bridgeport neighborhood. It's the best donut I've ever eaten. They dropped off some donuts for us. They're celebrating National Donut Day tomorrow by giving away 2 free donuts per guest. I've already eaten 3.5, so I'm going to say you're going to need to buy some more. In addition to that.
And it's called Fabulous Freddy's?
Fabulous Freddy's. And yep. It was warm. It was kind of like when you put powdered sugar on French toast with butter.
Yeah, you never talk about Pat Boyle this way.
No, I don't. But This is, I've now put them in the category of my favorite donut ever.
So this is like Vicki Lawrence's dentist fetish. This is your donut moment.
Oh, yeah, this is. So
I get it completely. By the way, I do deserve a little credit. That's the first sugar I've had all morning, and there was a box of candy bars here. Let me tell you something. Right. You want to get me to do anything, including bark at the moon, throw a little chocolate in front of me? I'm weak. So the fact is I haven't touched a candy all morning. Thanks for fixing me up.
You're welcome.
Jen Weigel's here. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great to see you. You look fabulous.
Thank you. So do you.
Nicely done the other day. Now, listen, it's been 2 weeks or so since the Silver Circle Awards, but the great Tim Weigel was honored. And you guys made it a whole family affair.
We did. My stepmom, Vicki, my sister, Teddy, just graduated from George Washington. She's on the road with Hillary right now.
Oh, wow.
She's got hired by the Hillary campaign, and myself, and we got up and said a few words posthumously for Tim.
Yeah, and you had a great message. So I know your dad's very proud of you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, so talk to me about these shows coming up.
So, as my second home, the Wilmette Theater, mm-hmm. I'll be doing Friday Funnies. We've been doing a stand-up show the first Friday of every month in Wilmette.
That's great.
Since February, and we are having such a blast. Sally Haas is going to be there.
Good.
We've got a lot of
Sally's
great comics.
Good woman.
Yeah, so that's Friday night, and then I've been on the road with psychics and mediums. As you said, my dad would be so proud, but I've continued to interview people.
Yeah, it's funny you said it. I would love to hear what Tim would say about this phase of your life.
Right.
Because it would be entertaining.
Well, I've been interviewing people in the paranormal space ever since he died.
Yeah, because it's his deal.
Yeah, it's his fault. If he hadn't died, I wouldn't be on this path.
Yeah.
And he's a mic hog. At every show, he shows up. He is, seriously.
What'd you call him, a Mike Hogg?
A Mike Hogg.
Oh, a Mike Hogg. I thought there was some psychic term I wasn't familiar with.
A microphone hog.
A Mike Hogg, well.
Yes, yes. Yeah. No, but it's been really interesting. So we're going to be, I'm going to be with Thomas John, the Manhattan medium, in the Dells on Saturday at the Palace Theater.
In the Dells?
The Dells, baby.
You're going to ride the ducks while you're there?
Maybe. We might hit a water park. Who knows? Yeah. Mediums have fun, too. And then Monday night, we're going to be back at the Wilmette Theater for a show at 7 p.m. with Manhattan.
Do mediums have trouble going out, though, because they know if it's going to be a good night?
Well, you know what's funny? I was in your neck of the woods in Minneapolis, your former neck of the woods.
My former home, yeah.
Doing some investigating for a father-son ghost-busting team, okay? This is my life. Hi, how you doing?
Father-son ghost-busting
team. For my next book, Michael Bodine and his son Blake do ghost busts. And I thought, you know, I thought my job was crazy. So I'm FaceTiming my son afterwards. He's like, hi, Mom. How was the ghost busting?
Hi, Mama. That's cute.
And I'm like, well, hold on. Here's Michael. He'll tell you. You know, we did this FaceTime.
So they go into these houses and try to scare the spirits out.
And it's funny because he says to me, you know, look, I've got a cross around my neck because he's a big, you know, believer of the light. You know, a lot of people say this is darkness, but he's like, look, there's light, there's dark. I go in, I believe in the light. He goes, but if you've got a Jewish ghost, they don't really care that you're Christian.
You know what? Fair. I didn't think you could bring, I didn't think you could bring faith into ghost busting, but
apparently
why wouldn't you?
Apparently you can.
It's the foundation of all of it.
But yeah, so some of these conversations are in my podcast too, which I'm Spiritual Dammit, I'm so excited to say is doing well in WGN Plus.
Good.
So
very nice.
If anybody wants to know more, just go to jenweigel.com and click on gigs and you can see the schedule from comedy to Thomas John.
And you're working on the new thing is that book or you got two books?
I handed in my fourth book on Monday. So can I just do a little happy dance about that?
Yeah, you should.
All right.
Four books. I got 40. I started.
You did? Want help finishing? I'm your gal.
Yeah, I would need help finishing.
Okay.
Yeah,
I read one and two. I have to read three.
Oh,
awesome.
Shoot. I would have
read
Jen's
stuff.
They're great reads.
Yeah. No. Oh, you were talking about Jen.
I am talking about Jen's books. I read your book.
Thank you, honey.
Well,
are you going to come to Thomas John Monday night in Wilmette?
Yes. By the way, speaking of stand-up, this one, Andre
rocked
Nellis,
it.
Yeah.
She's
done stand-up twice now, and she's foolish enough to do it again.
Andre, do you want to come to Friday Funnies?
Yeah, you need
July
to do
1st
that.
Or August 12th?
You need to do
we
that.
Got a slot for you.
Well, would I headline, or would I just open?
Whatever you want.
You guys can talk off the air. A couple of minutes before 10, Bill and Wendy are next. What's the contact for you again?
JenWeigel.com.
JenWeigel.com.